Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Ready to lay down some EB5 information, Mona?
So Mark, you know, there are not too many mediums to get information from, or I should say accurate, up-to-date information with relation to EB5. In fact, Hermione and myself were just redoing a little blog piece about how few areas there are. But one of the places that we can actually say that we get information is from ILW. So we thought it would be a wonderful idea to bring in the editor of ILW, Sam Udani, who we have known for many years. We've worked with him going all the way back to 2010 in the EB5 space. To come on to our show to let us know about not only his wonderful controversial editorials, and we have a number of questions for you, Sam, on that.
Sure.
But also to ask about where we are, because we are like, what, 54 days out from when we should be filing. So there is this mass panic going on. There is, I just came back.
Yeah, Mona, you've just got back from another trip.
That's right. I was in Riyadh and I was in Dubai, where I was inundated, Mark, inundated with people. There is a panic out there. I think that Sam is going to reflect the same. Sam, welcome to our show.
Delighted to be here.
You market overseas, mostly at this point in India.
We are doing India and Turkey this month, but you're quite right. We have been about 90% India in the last year and a half, because that's where the EB5 market has been.
And are you seeing a swell of numbers or a panic at this point?
We're not seeing a panic yet. We are expecting a panic, and we expect that that will develop in the late part of October. That's my best guess. However, what we are seeing is not increased numbers, but a complete change in attitude amongst the attendees who come and participants and investors who are looking for opportunities to make an EB5 investment. We see that they are much more serious, much more focused, much more inclined to make decisions within a matter of weeks instead of the usual 3 months, 6 months, 9 months that we are used to.
They don't have that time. Right. But even, you're saying mass panic, even now we are pushing for time because some of these petitions are really taking us time. There are the source of funds from India are not straightforward. Mm-hmm. And the projects themselves take time to put together. It takes sometimes several weeks just to get a TEA designation. So we don't have an awful lot of time, Sam.
No, time is very short. I mean, if you look at the whole market as a whole, I don't see a panic situation, but we can clearly see one developing shortly.
You said you're also in Turkey.
Yes, we've been to Turkey. We've done events, maybe about 8 or 10 events in the last 6 years in Turkey. And we're going to be doing events in Izmir, Ankara, and Istanbul, both the Asian and the European sides of Istanbul.
Interesting. So, Sam, you run this wonderful editorial, and we all look forward to reading it every day to see all the gems of wisdom. And over the last several years, especially since 2015, when there has been a deadline and we've had legislation introduced, you have been, I would say, amazingly accurate with some of your predictions. Do you have insider information that we don't have?
Well, of course we have insider information, and that's natural because we are publishers in the immigration field. We publish a newspaper on immigration law. I've been involved in immigration legislation for the last 22 years. And in the last 22 years, if there was anything, even a mouse moving on the floor of Congress to do with immigration legislation, I would know about it earlier than I would know about the weather outside my window. So, yes, we certainly have many sources of information, as any newspaper would.
Because we were so sure that the regs were not going to come in and that the regs were being stalled. And then the regs came in and you had predicted that. You had predicted that Trump would turn. You had predicted that he would be for the regs because it benefited people within the constituents who voted for him.
Well, I mean, the argument, Stephen Miller runs immigration policy in the Trump White House. I don't think that's a secret. And he has been pushing all the immigration agencies, whether it's CBP, ICE, or USCIS, to embark upon an agenda of significant regulatory change. And he was yelling and screaming at the USCIS management until the current acting USCIS director took over. And he was yelling and screaming, saying that there's not sufficient production of regulations. Now, this is amongst the serious regulations that USCIS could rush into publication, and they did so. And from what I have heard, it was done after due political consideration. The acting USCIS director, he specifically decided that this would help Mr. Trump politically, and that is the reason why he went ahead and did it, and he has Mr. Trump's backing.
Right. And we all thought that Mr. Trump would be, the president would be very pro EB5, because that's what we had been predicting since he entered office. But saying that, right now we have two pieces of pending legislation. One, which has been brought out by the EB5 stakeholders with the backing of Lindsey Graham. It's not actually out yet, but it's just about to come out. And one which was just released just last week from Senator Grassley.
So you're referring to Senator Grassley's legislation and the other one from Representative Amodai, right?
Well, the other one within this week, we're not sure who...
The IIUSA written legislation, the compromise legislation of the industry.
That's right. Right. That's right, yes.
Well, so you want my comments on those two pieces of legislation, those two bills? Well, one of them has been introduced and one hasn't. Let's look at the compromise bill first. The compromise bill, first of all, it's a product of many years of work. And many stakeholders have had a say in the final product. And I believe that we do have a final product.
It's the first time all the stakeholders are really in sort of unanimous consent.
Well, I would take that with a grain of salt. And I'll tell you why. That unanimous consent, which existed, and you're quite right about that, but it existed before the regulations came out. I think that the fact that the regulations are now out since July 23rd has changed the equation. And I think that the rural interests who were part of the original compromise are probably going to be changing their mind. Not yet, not now, because nobody's trying to make enemies. That's not the point. The point is that making legislation involves give and take. It involves compromise. It involves back and forth. It involves a lot of nitty-gritty over very detailed language. And at that point, if one side feels that the status quo strongly benefits them, then that is going to change the way they behave. So I'm suggesting that very likely the rural interests will turn out to have less of a compromising attitude once that give and take commences. So I do not therefore believe that there is much hope for this compromise legislation to immediately become law. I think it has very strong legs maybe in a few years from now, 2 to 3 years. But in this Congress, and especially in this year, I would say that the compromise legislation is on life support because of the regulations. So that's my comment on that first bill.
We've covered the new regulations pretty deeply and quite frequently ever since, the new regulations were announced. And we've asked various guests about litigation, and it seems across the board that litigation isn't going to happen.
There will be litigation. I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't think it'll succeed.
Successful litigation.
Well, I mean, again, I'm not an expert on APA litigation, but I have talked to several experts on APA litigation. And unfortunately, USCIS is well known for playing fast and loose with the Administrative Procedure Act. And that's why appeals on specific issues on APA matters against USCIS often succeed in achieving the result, even if they may not necessarily see their day in court. You often win against USCIS in that way because they don't follow the law. But in this case, from everything I have been told, and again, I'm not an APA expert, but from those who are experts, they're telling me that the APA has been followed to the letter in making and framing these regulations. And in that context, to expect a change through litigation is not very likely.
I agree, actually. So, you put out a blog piece just recently, A Whole New EB5 World.
Yes.
It raised a lot of eyebrows. I have a number of questions for you,
sure,
Sam, because
sure.
I have to say I don't quite agree with you on all of your surmises. And you have been, as I said, uncannily accurate in the past. But here, For example, you state that Congress will not get to EB5 until 2020.
Yes.
And here I don't disagree, because if the bill is attached to the appropriations bill, then the appropriations bill is not going to be dealt with this year, but next year it may be dealt with at the start of the year. But saying that, right now Congress is in a bit of a mess because of the whole impeachment issue, and 2020 looks like is a presidential year. Mm-hmm. So it really looks like we may not get to any EB5 legislation maybe until the following year.
Yes, yes, you're quite right. It could be 2021. I use 2020, it could even be 2022. I use 2020 as a minimum guidance. At the time that the whole EB5 New World was published, and that was only a couple of weeks ago. It looks like a couple of years, you know, as the pace of events in EB5 has dramatically accelerated. So yes, at the time we sent it out, there was a sentiment that, oh, we're going to see some legislation right away, as in before September 30th.
Right.
And that's not realistic.
What about Senator Grassley's bill?
All right. So now that is a very interesting development, because if you notice, as compared to his previous bills, he has excised all the portions dealing with set-asides. He has excised all the portions dealing with TEAs. He has excised all the portions dealing with investment amounts. So what remains is the integrity portion of the bill.
To which no one has any objection.
Well, there's two parts to it. I think at a conceptual level, everyone, including myself, have strongly supported Mr. Grassley's and Mr. Leahy's push to bring more accountability, more transparency, and some teeth into EB5 regulation. I don't think there is any problem with the concept. The problem is in the application. If the cost of compliance with these integrity measures is so high that, you know, it's incredible. Let's say it's $1 million a project. It's just as an example. It could very well be a very large number. Then two things happen. One, the only people who could spend that much money on compliance would be the very large projects, and most of them tend to be urban projects, which under the new regulations are probably out of the EB5 market for good. And two, and this is the most important one, the intention of Congress throughout the EB5 program has always been to make it possible for an individual entrepreneur who wants to do their own direct EB5 to be able to do it. Now, I'm not certain whether that would be possible under the integrity bill that Mr. Leahy and Mr. Grassley have introduced, because the compliance cost would be so high that it wouldn't make sense for a single investor project to even get off the ground. So in that sense, I think a lot of people support the concepts, but it seems like the medicine is so tough it might kill the patient.
Right. I agree. Well, we're going to discuss more about the integrity measures later. But I'd certainly agree with you about that. So your blog piece relating to a whole new EB5 world is that we are going to have to live with the regulations.
Yes.
And the consequences thereof.
Yes.
Your a whole new EB5 world, we have to live with the regs.
Yes.
The reality of living with the regulations, quite frankly, is that most of these urban projects will be at 1.8 and out of the reach of most investors.
Yes, they will be dead as dodo, as far as I can see.
What I find very worrying is the fact that if many of these regional centers have no active participation post-November, or rather post-November 21, will they become inactive? What happens to investors?
Well, I mean, the large urban developers, the ones who have dominated the market in China for the last 5 years, they are the ones who will be exiting the primary EB5 market. They're not going to be exiting the secondary EB5 market. So let me explain that. So at the $1.8 million, it doesn't make sense for almost anyone across the world to choose an urban project over a rural one. The
right.
opportunity cost is just too much. The differential is too high. So presuming that not even 1% of the capital goes into these urban projects after November 21st, we have to presume that it doesn't make sense for them to remain in the market, and they'll withdraw their offerings. So they're out of the primary market. But there are two ways in which they're still in the market. One is that they have existing responsibilities to their investors for ongoing projects, existing compliance responsibilities, including future compliance measures. And in that sense, I don't think those regional centers are going to be inactive. They're going to be active for many, many, many years as these investors cycle out of these projects gradually. But the second point, which is perhaps even more important, is the fact of redeployment.
Right.
Most of these projects are going to be completed in a fairly short time frame, as in 5 years or less. And then, you know, not just the Chinese, but even the Indians and Vietnamese are going to have to wait a lot longer than that. So redeployment is going to keep them very busy, and it's extremely profitable.
Right.
Right? So that's going to keep them very busy. So I don't think we have seen the last of the large urban developers. But I do think that at least until Congress comes back to the subject, they will leave the primary EB-5 market.
Well, I agree. And I do think, and we've already seen a number of, not necessarily the larger regional centers, but maybe mid-size closing their doors or saying that this is their last EB-5 raise. And perhaps really cutting down their administrative staff to maybe one person or two people.
Exactly. We've seen that. We've heard of rumors of even good-sized regional centers fire more than a dozen people.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we have to live with that. Now, secondly, there are a lot of areas within the urban areas which could house a TEA that we've already started scoping.
I have some points on that.
Please.
So a lot of our clients, and I'm sure a lot of the people that you talk to and who you assist in their EB-5 raises, are telling us, look, under the new calculations, under the November 21st regulations, we are going to still be in a TEA, even though we are in a country, in a city, in an MSA. I'm not so sure. And let me explain what I mean. I think that eventually they'll be right. But the key problem is that we don't have any clarifications from USCIS on how they will read their own regulations. And they are notorious for misreading their own regulations. So until we have a policy memo from USCIS on TEA calculations, which could take 3 months, it could take 6 months, it could take a year, whenever it comes out, until then, we have a bit of uncertainty because there's no more safe harbor. There is no more letter from a county or a city or a state which tells you that you are in a TEA. There's no safe harbor anymore. So if, as an immigration attorney, if you're faced with counseling an investor after November 21st, and he says to you, I have two choices. One is a rural project surrounded only by cows. And here is this urban project, which is in an MSA. And I'm really worried about the TEA situation. I think most immigration attorneys are going to say, look, if you're surrounded only by cows and you're truly rural, then you have
No, not necessarily, because we have seen projects where you're surrounded by cows, which do not have viability. And at the end
they
of the
may
day,
not be viable, but that's a different calculation. It's not a TEA calculation. I'm speaking narrowly about TEAs. And my point is that
we're talking about, even if you're talking about putting 900,000, even at 500,000, people are very, very, very careful. 900, and it's not going to be 900. It's going to be more than a million. By the time you add administrative fees and legal fees, etc., it's going to be close to a million, if not more. We have to have projects which are viable. Otherwise, the whole EB-5 program collapses.
Well, viable has two components. One is it eventually successful? So, and if you say that, look, we need projects which are eventually successful, you are completely right, and no one can argue against that. But if you mean as in viable, as in determining the likelihood of success prior to investment, that is a matter which EB-5 broker-dealers would be more qualified to address. I don't think either myself, as simply a publisher of a newspaper, or any immigration attorney in the country can pass on the viability of a project as in terms of making a projection as to its likelihood of success. You know, of course, some projects fail and some projects succeed, and that is true in every area of endeavor. But and it is certainly true when you have less of a choice in terms of project selection, then, you know, people have to be much more careful that they don't lose their money. I completely agree.
Very true, Sam. But we're talking about credibility, not just viability. And we're also talking about where investors feel comfortable in putting their money. We've seen this. We've seen the fact that investors time and time again feel comfortable in coming to the big cities. They feel there's a viability and a credibility there. Most projects outside of MSAs don't succeed in getting as much attention as the projects within MSAs. And as I said, we have seen this time and time again, even today. So, you know, the credibility is not there if you're talking about going out to where just the cows are.
Well, there are two issues here. One is relativeness, and the other one is also relativeness, but from a different angle. And you raise a very important point. What you say is that, look, over the last 5 years, a lot of that investment that has come into EB-5 has come into metropolitan areas, into MSAs, into large cities, particularly New York, Miami, Los Angeles. And in that sense, one could impute that projects in urban areas are credible, quote unquote, as compared to projects in rural areas. Now, that would be correct if you are looking backwards. But that is the whole point about a whole new EB5 world. We are not looking backwards. We are looking forward. And when we are looking forward, we realize that credibility is a relative issue, not an absolute one. Which means if the investors have to choose between rural projects in 6 rural states, they will find one or two of those more, quote, credible, unquote, than others. In the sense that what I'm saying is that we have seen, we have a couple of dozen clients in rural areas of the United States, and they don't even get a second glance when there is a choice for the investor to invest in Miami or New York or LA.
Right? That's our point, yes.
But the moment that choice is taken away from the investor, now all of a sudden, they're going to start comparing one rural project with another, and they may well find some of them to be credible.
Yeah. Post-1121, we are looking at a different portfolio of investors, the real qualified investors, not necessarily the investors who are just pulling 100 here and 100 there. So surely the real investors will have more facilities and be more inclined to invest in an urban development.
Well, let me put it this way. That's a very important point, which is, what will the investors be like? I can see what the projects will be like. I can tell you as best as I can tell that rural projects will dominate the market for a little while until USCIS issues a clarification. And I encourage them to do so. I encourage USCIS to come up with a policy memo. I think it's a good idea for everybody, including USCIS, to have a clear statement that they'll follow their own regulation. Okay? And that'll help everyone, including rural projects, actually. I think everyone gets help with clarity. But knowing past practice, they take their own time. We could be well into 2020 before they get around to issuing the memo. So in that interregnum, I expect that we will see rural projects dominate the market. The urban high unemployment TA projects will return to the market once we have some clarity from
the
USCIS.
Right, correct.
Okay. Now, the point that you are raising has nothing to do with projects. It has to do with investors. And that is a completely different point. And on that issue, I don't think anyone knows. I certainly don't. As to what will the investors look like, what we can say is that they'll be very different. Somebody who puts in $900,000 is likely to have a very different wealth profile, very different appetite, very different risk appetite, maybe very different countries. We expect they're going to be completely non-traditional countries. Right now, we are seeing a huge burst of investment from Brazil and Korea. Okay, so therefore, I would not be surprised if post November 21st, at some point, the State Department announces that they feel the necessity to impose a cutoff date for Brazil and Korea.
Sam, neither the legislation, except for the industry legislation, nor the regs address what is the real crisis right now, which are visa backlogs for what are more and more countries as we move forward. But the one thing, I mean, I know in your comment on A Whole New EB5 World, you do comment about the what you see as a backlog for India, for example. What we have seen and what has been proven by the last quarter is that the amount of cases being declined or denied by USCIS has multiplied. Whereas we used to have, around a threshold around about the 85, 89 mark of successful cases, we're now at 60 and less. There is a very high amount of cases which are being denied. And what we see internally is that the increase in the Indian market has a lot to do with this because of the difficulties that they have in sourcing funds, in putting them together. Perhaps it's attorneys who really don't know what they're doing because we have a more of a spread of different attorneys now who are doing EB5, where it didn't used to be that way.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is that the Indian backlog may not be as bad as 10 years because a large number of people may
get
denied.
We would argue that it'd be 5 years, not 10.
Yeah, and the reason you're offering is because the denial rate could be very, very high. Is that correct?
Partly that, partly people finding alternatives. A lot of people have done EB2s and then they have done EB5 as backups. You know, things change.
Well, let me put it this way. There's many issues here. Firstly, even if there is a very large backlog, let's say 15 years, just use a hypothetical large number, it's not going to affect the Indian market very much because the comparative rate for EB2, EB3, if you're talking of 50 years, 100
75
years.
75 to 135 years.
Or maybe more, exactly. And when you're comparing a number like 15 with another number like 115, 15 doesn't sound so bad. right? So firstly, I don't think that the backlog should scare any of the issuers away, and it shouldn't even scare any of the investors away, because it is a comparative number. That's the first point. Secondly, you're quite right that the backlog is a subject to dynamic change, including large number of denials. And I'd like to say two things there. First, I'm sorry to say, but there is a fair amount of questionable projects out there in terms of usually, you know, a small group of investors from India get together, three or six people, friends and family, and they don't have their documents in order. And USCIS finds it rather easy to deny those cases. And that's a crying shame, because if they just had better counsel and better preparation, many of those projects would have been approved, right?
Yeah,
many of those investors would have had a much happier result. Right. And secondly, the point is, you're quite right. I mean, people are playing the EB2 versus EB5 game, right? And they sometimes have dual lines, and EB2 could happen earlier. We don't know, right? So, yeah, I agree. And of course, source of funds is very challenging. You're completely right. There's a large number of attorneys with very limited experience, and sometimes no experience at all, in putting together source of funds documents. And they are, they're learning as they go. And that is unfortunately making guinea pigs out of their clients. And it's not a very happy situation for anyone, including those attorneys who get those denials. And that has been happening in increasing amount. And I do foresee that increasing. So I would not object to someone suggesting that the denial rate is going to be sky high. I think the denial rate will be very, very high. And if you say that will affect the backlog, that's a valid argument. That's a valid argument. I would say that, yes, that will affect the backlog and make it shorter. I agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, the problem is as well is that clients often ask if they're looking at project denials, have exemplar petitions been, approved? Well, it's taking 3 years right now to get an exemplar petition approved. It's impossible to tell. So we have a lot of issues that we're looking at.
You know, Mona, it might be time for a magical conversational artifact.
Sam, we often give our guests on this show a magic wand. And but today, I'm taking away that magic wand.
Oh, my.
Okay. And I'm giving you a crystal ball.
Oh, I like that.
So here's your crystal ball.
Okay.
How do you envisage EB5? Let's say 2 years, year and a half to 3 years to 4 years.
Well, several things, and I think all of them are in various ways positive. One is, I think the program will exist. That has become very, very clear. We have actual evidence from over 60, 70 events in these last 2 months that there is a tremendous amount of interest in the post-November 21st world. So the program will exist. There's no question about that. That means investment will continue to come into America. Jobs will continue to get created by EB-5 funds, and those individuals who take the risk in investing in their American dream will get their green card. So all of those, I think, will continue. So that is a positive thing. Second, I think in terms of projects, I think we will find, of course, smaller projects in terms of total number of investors.
Well, that's happened even now.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I think that trend will continue. I think it will also be more geographically dispersed than it has been. Right. So we'll be seeing a new kind of project. That, I think, is also true. But thirdly and lastly is the new kind of investor. We are going to see new countries come to the fore, countries which have not traditionally been big in EB-5, and mainly because the leading countries may have already shot their bolt and may need a year or two or more to recover. And in that interim period, we will see countries which had done less than 10 or less than 20 EB-5 investments per year jump.
Such as?
Well, it's very hard to say. I wish I could name in particular. But one of the countries I'm thinking about is Thailand. And it's possible that Thailand might see, because of the local political situation there, might see a large number of high net worth individuals.
So now here the issue is, we already have clients who are from that area, quite a few clients, but then they're Indian born. Mm-hmm. Or there, and then we go back to the
issue. So I'm talking about Thai-born, Thailand
clients. I see,
clients.
Yeah.
Right. And that would be true for other non-traditional countries. I think Turkey is a good possibility of a big revival in their EB-5 standing and fortunes. There are others which are possible. I don't think I have a crystal ball of great clarity on where. All I can say is that it will be new countries which had not traditionally had high volumes suddenly develop higher volumes than they have in the past and will be more important in a relative scale in the year 2020.
And of course, each project will require less investors.
Exactly. Exactly. And the projects themselves may be smaller.
Right. I kind of agree.
Yeah, and perhaps smaller and more targeted, they'll run more efficiently.
Small is beautiful sometimes.
Sam Udani, thank you so much for joining us on EB5 Investment Voice.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.